If ever I forget it, my lord takes pains to make me remember again, seeing that he holds so many women better and more worthy than I. This she said, and she cast an oblique look at Wang the eldest, so that he broke into a light sweat and murmured in a feeble way, "Now, lady, when did I ever?" And he began to cast over in his mind if there had been any special thing he had done of late, of which she could have heard adversely. It was true he had found and sought the singing girl who was young and coy, and who had pleased him so well at a feast one night, and he had begun to visit her and to pay her a regular sum, and he had thoughts of establishing her somewhere in the town on a bounty as men do when they do not care to add the trouble of a new woman to their courts, yet desire her enough to keep her for themselves for a time at least. But this thing he had not yet accomplished, for the girl's mother lived, and she was such a greedy old hag that she would not come down to Wang the eldest's price for her daughter. So he thought his lady could not have heard of it before the thing was done, and he wiped his face with his sleeve again, and looked away from her and drank his tea heavily in loud sips. But the lady was not thinking of him this time, and she went on without heeding his muttering, and she said, "I have said to myself that, humble as I am and a mere woman, yet I am my son's mother, and I ought to come and thank my brother-in-law for what you have done for our worthless second son. And though my thanks can be nothing to one like you, yet it is my pleasure to do what I ought, and so I do in spite of every burden and slight I have to bear." Here she cast another of her looks at her lord, and he scratched his head and looked at her foolishly, and was all in a sweat again because he did not know what she was about to say, and being so fat he sweated nothing at all. But she went on, "So here be my thanks, brother-in-law, and worthless though they are, they come from a sincere heart. As for my son, I will say that if there is a lad worthy of your kindness, he is that one, and he is the kindest, best, and gentlest lad, and such a wise head as he has. I am his mother, and although it is said mothers see the best always in their children, still I will say again that we gave you the best son we have, my lord and I." All this time, Wang the tiger had sat and stared at her as his way was when anyone spoke, and he stared so strangely one could not know whether he heard what was said or not, except when his answer came, and it came now, brutal and blunt. "If that is so, sister-in-law, then I am sorry for your brother and you. He is the timidest, weakest lad I ever did see, and his gall is no larger than the gall in a white hen. I wish you could have given me your eldest son. He is a good, willful lad, and I could break him, and make him into something of a good, willful man, obedient to me, and none other. But this second son of yours is always weeping, and it is like carrying a leaking dipper with me everywhere. There is no breaking him, for he is nothing in him, and so no making him either. No, both my brother's lads disappoint me, for your lad is so soft and timid his brains are washed out in tears. And the other one is good and lusty and rough enough for the life, but he is thoughtless, and he loves his laughter, and he is a clown. And I do not know how high a clown can go. It is an evil thing for me that I have no son of my own to use now when I need him." Now what the lady might have said to such a speech as this, none knows. But Wang the eldest was trembling, for he knew no one had ever spoken to her so plainly as this before, and the high red was flooding into her face, and she opened her lips to make sharp answer. But before her voice could shape the words, her eldest son came suddenly from behind a curtain where he was listening, and he cried out eagerly, "Oh, let me go, my mother! I want to go!" There he stood before them all, eager and beautiful in his youth, and he looked quickly from one face to the other. He wore a bright blue gown the color of a peacock's feathers, such as young lords love to wear, and shoes of foreign leather, and he had a jade ring on his finger, and his hair was cut in the newest fashion, and smoothed back with fragrant oil. He was pale as young men in rich houses are pale who never need to labor or be burned by the sun, and his hands were soft as a woman's hands. Yet there was something very lusty in his looks, too, for all his beauty and paleness, and he had a good, impatient eye. Nor did he move languidly when he forgot himself and forgot that it was the fashion for young men about town to be languid and careless of anything. No, he could be as he was now, his languor all laid aside, when he was full of the flame of a desire. But his mother cried out sharply, "Now this is the greatest nonsense I ever heard, for you are the eldest son, and after your father the head of the house. And how can we let you go to wars, and perhaps even go to a battle and be killed? We have spared nothing at all for you, and we have sent you to every school in this town and hired scholars to teach you, and we have loved you too well to send you south to a school even. And how can we let you go to war? Then seeing that Wang the eldest sat there silent and hanging his head, she said sharply, "My lord, am I to take this whole burden on myself too?" Then Wang the eldest said feebly, "Your mother is right, my son. She is always right, and we cannot spare you to such hazard." But the young man, although he was nearly 19 years old, began to stamp his feet and to weep and to storm, and he ran and beat his head against the door lintel, and he cried out, "I shall poison myself if I cannot do what I like." Then his parents rose up in great dismay, and the lady cried out that the young lord's servant was to be sent for. And when the man came running in terror, she cried to him, "Take the child to some place for play, and divert him, and see if this anger can go out of him." And Wang the eldest made haste to take a good handful of silver out of his girdle, and he pressed it upon his son, and said, "Take it, my son, and go and buy yourself something you like, or use it for a game, or whatever you like." At first the lad pushed the silver away and made as if he would not have such consolation. But the manservant coaxed and besought him, so that after a while the youth took the silver as though very unwillingly, and then flinging himself about and crying out that he would go, and he would go with his uncle, he suffered himself to be led away. When it was over, the lady sank upon a chair, and she sighed piteously, and she gasped, "He has always had such a spirit. We have not known how to do with him. He is much harder to teach than the one we gave you." Now Wang the tiger had sat gravely and watched all that passed, and now he said, "It is easier to teach where there is a will than where there is nothing. I could make that lad if I had him, and all this storming is because he has not been taught." But the lady had been too put about to endure more, and she would not bear it to have it said her sons were not well taught. So she rose in her majestic way, and she said, and she bowed, "Doubtless you have much to say to each other." And she went out. Then Wang the tiger looked at his eldest brother with a grim pity, and they said nothing for a time. Only Wang the eldest began to drink his wine again, but not with any zest now, and his fat face was mournful. At last he said more thoughtfully than he usually spoke, and he sighed heavily before he spoke, "There is a thing that is a riddle to me, and it is this, that a woman can be so yielding and delicate and pliant to man's will when she is young, and when her years come on her she grows another person altogether, and is so scolding and troublesome and devoid of all reason as to keep a man dazed. I swear sometimes I will keep off all women, for I do believe my second one will learn of the first one, and they are all so." And he looked at his brother with a strange envy, and with eyes as sorrowful as a great child's, and he said sadly, "You are fortunate and more fortunate than I. You are free of women, and you are free of land. Twice bound I am. I am bound by this accursed land my father left me. If I do not attend to it, we have nothing from it, for these accursed country folk are all robbers and leagued against the landlord, however just and good he be. And as for my steward, who has ever heard of an honest man who was a steward?" He drew down his thick mouth plaintively, and he sighed again and looked again at his brother and said, "Yes, you are fortunate. You have no land, and you are bound to no woman at all." And Wang the tiger replied in greatest scorn, "I do not know any women at all." And he was glad when the 4 days were gone, and he could go to the courts of Wang the second. Now when Wang the tiger came into his second brother's house, he could not but marvel to see how different it was from the others, and how full of high good humor, in spite of bickering and quarreling among the children too. And all the noise and good humor swelled and centered about Wang the second's country wife. She was a noisy, boisterous creature, and whenever she spoke, her voice rang through the house, she was so ruddy and loud. Yet, although she lost her temper 10 times a day, and knocked this child's head against that one's, or flung her arm out, with its sleeve forever rolled above her elbow, and slapped some child's cheek with a crack, so that the house was full of roaring and bawling from morning until night, and every servant was as loud as the mistress, yet she was fond, too, in her rough way, and she would seize a child who passed and nuzzle her nose into his fat neck. and while she could be so saving of money, yet when a child came crying for a penny to buy a lump of candy or a bowl of some hot sweet stuff from a passing vendor, or a stick of Haws dipped in sugar, or some such thing children love, she always reached into her deep bosom and fumbled out a penny. Through this noisy, lusty house, Wang the Second moved quiet and serene, and filled with his secret plans. And he was always well pleased with them all, and he and his wife lived content with each other. For the first time, Wang the Tiger in these days laid aside for the present his plans of glory, and while his men rested and feasted, he lived in his brother's house, and there was something here in Wang the Second's house that he liked. He saw why his pocked nephew came out of this home merry and laughing, and how the other one was always timid and fearful. And he felt the content between Wang the Second and his wife, and he felt the content the children had too, although they were not washed often, nor did any servant take heed of them beyond seeing them fed by day and put into some bed or other at night. But every child was merry out of all the crew, and Wang the Tiger watched them everywhere with some strange moving in his heart. There was one boy of 5 years or so, and Wang the Tiger watched him most, for he was the roundest, fairest boy, and Wang the Tiger yearned for him somehow. But when he reached his hand out diffidently to the child, or found a penny and held it to him, the boy was suddenly grave, and put his finger in his mouth and stared at Wang the Tiger's grave looks, and ran away shaking his head. And Wang the Tiger was as pained by this refusal as though the boy were a man, although he tried to smile and make it nothing. Thus Wang the Tiger waited for these 7 days to pass, and his rare idleness made him more thoughtful than he usually was. And seeing these two houses full of children, he felt afresh his lack that he had no son to be knit to him. And he thought on, and a little, about women, for this was the first time he had lived freely in a house where there were wives and maidservants and young slaves running here and there. And there was some strange sweet stir in him sometimes, when he saw a slender maid with her back turned to him at some task she had, and he could remember once Pear Blossom had looked so about these very courts, where he had been a lad. But when the maid turned and he saw her face, his old confusion fell on him, and the truth was there had been in that youth of his such a sealing of his fountains that at the sight of any woman's face there was some stopping in his heart, and he turned himself away. Still in his idleness, and with this faint stir in him too, he was restless, and one afternoon he told himself he would go and pay his respects to Lotus, for it was in Lotus's courts he used most often to see Pear Blossom in those old days, and he had a secret fancy to see the rooms again and the court. He went then to Lotus, having first sent his servant to announce his coming, and Lotus rose from the table where she sat gaming with her friends, the old ladies of other houses. But he would not sit long. No, he cast his eyes about this room, and he remembered it, and then he wished he had not come, and he rose and was restless again and would not stay. But Lotus did not understand his brooding looks, and she cried out, "Stay, for I have sugar ginger in a jar, and I have sweetened lotus root and such things as young men love. I have not forgotten what young men are like, no, for all I am so old and fat, I do remember how you all are." And she laid her hand on his arm, and she laughed her thick laugh and leered at him. Then he loathed her suddenly, and he stiffened himself and bowed, and made his excuses again, and he went away quickly. But he heard the cackling laughter of the old women as they gamed, and it followed him through the courts. Yet even as he went, his remembrance made him more restless, and he said to harden himself that his life was very far from here now, and he must be on his way. And as soon as he had visited once his father's grave, as it was his duty to do, and especially before he went on with his venture, he would be away once more and out of these courts. So on the next morning, the sixth day, he said to Wang the Second, "I will not stay longer than to burn a little incense at my father's grave, else my men will be growing lax and lazy, and there is a long, fierce road ahead. What have you to say of the monies I need?" And Wang the Second said, "Nothing, except that I will give you every month what we have agreed." But Wang the Tiger cried impatiently, "Be sure I will return you one day all you lend me. Now I go to my father's grave. Do you, then, see that the two lads are ready for me, and that they are not drunken or overfed tonight, for we set forth at dawn tomorrow." And he went away, half wishing he need not take his elder brother's son again, but not knowing how to refuse, lest it breed jealousy. And as he went, he took a little incense from a store kept in the house, and he went out to his father's grave. Now these two, father and son, had been very far apart when they lived, and even Wang the Tiger's childhood had been bitter, because his father had said he must stay on the land, and Wang the Tiger had grown up hating the land. He hated it now, and as he drew near to the earthen house, which was his, he hated it, although it had been his childhood home. He did not love it because it had been a prison to him once, and he had thought he would never be free of it. He did not go near it, but he circled around and drew near through a small grove of trees to the hillock where were set the graves of the family. As he drew near with his swift steps, he heard a low, soft sound as though one wept, and when he heard it, he wondered who could weep at that grave, for he knew Lotus was gaming, and well he knew it could not be she. He softened his striding then, and he drew near, and he peered through the trees. There was the strangest sight he had ever seen. Pear Blossom leaned her head upon his father's grave, and she sat crouched in the grass in the way that women have when they weep and think no one near and they can weep on uncomforted. Not far from her sat his sister, the Fool, whom he had not seen these many years, and now, although her hair was nearly white and her face shrunken and small, she sat in a spot of autumn sunlight and played at a bit of red cloth, folding and refolding it, and smiling to see the sun on it so red. And holding to her coat faithfully, as a child does who has been bid to do something for one he loves, sat a small, twisted, hunched boy. He had his face turned sorrowfully to the weeping woman, and his mouth was all puckered, and he was near to weeping, too, for her sake. Wang the Tiger stood there, stricken motionless with his surprise, and he listened to Pear Blossom mourning on in that soft, low way she had, as though the weeping came from some innermost part of her. And suddenly he could not bear it. No, all his old anger fell once more against his father, and he could not bear it. He dropped the incense there where he stood, and he turned and walked quickly away, breathing heavily in great sighs as he went, although he did not know he did. He rushed back over the land, and he only knew he must be away from this place, this land, this woman. He must be at his own business. He walked back through the hard autumn sunlight, falling brilliant and clear across the fields, but he saw none of it and noted no beauty. At dawn he was up and on his red horse, and the horse was curvetting and impatient in the chill air, and his hooves thudded heavily upon the cobbled street, and the pocked lad, well fed with all he had eaten for his morning meal, was on his ass, and they rode around to the gate of Wang the eldest to fetch that other lad. But before they could wait at all, a manservant came running out of the gate, and he cried as he ran somewhere, "What a thing of evil is this! What a curse upon this house!" And he ran his way somewhere. Then Wang the Tiger felt his impatience rise in him, and he shouted out, "What curse is it? Curse it is that the sun is near the horizon, and I am not on my way yet." But the man did not look back. Then Wang the Tiger cursed very heartily, and he cried to the pocked lad, "That cursed lad, your cousin, is nothing but a burden to me, and never will be else. Go and find him, and tell him he is to come, or I will not have him." The pocked lad slid down at once from his small old ass, and ran in, and more slowly Wang the Tiger came down from his horse, and went to the gate and gave the reins over to the gateman to hold for him. But before he could go further, the lad was out again, white as a spirit, and breathing as fast as though he had run around the town walls. He gasped out between his breaths, "He will never come again. He is hung and dead." "What do you say, you small monkey?" shouted Wang the Tiger, and he leaped and ran into his brother's house. There was confusion indeed, and men and women and servants and all were gathered about something in the court, and above the din and shouting a woman's loud shrieks were heard, and it was the lad's mother who so cried. But Wang the Tiger pushed them aside, and in the center of the crowd was Wang the eldest. His fat face was yellow as old tallow, and all shaken with tears, and he held supported in his arms the body of his second son. The lad lay there outstretched in the court, under the bright morning sky, dead, and his head hung back over his father's arm. He had hanged himself with his girdle upon the beam in the room where he slept with his elder brother, and the brother had not known it until he woke in the morning, for he slept hard after wine at some merrymaking the night before. When he woke in the pale dawn and saw the slight form dangling, he thought at first it was a garment, and he wondered why it hung there. But when he looked again, he screamed, and so woke the house. Then Wong the Tiger, when one had told him this tale and a score of others helped in the telling, stood and looked down on this dead son with the strangest feeling, and he pitied this lad for a while as he never had when the lad was alive. He was so very small and slight now he was dead, and Wong the eldest looked up and saw his brother there, and he blubbered, "I never dreamed this child of mine would choose death to going with you. You must have treated him very ill to make him hate you like this. Well for you that you are my brother, or I would... "No, brother," said Wong the Tiger, more gently than he was used to speak. "I do not treat him ill. He even had an ass to ride when others older than he walked. But neither did I dream he was brave enough to die. I might have made something of him after all if I had known he had in him the power to die." He stood and stared a while. But bustle began suddenly when the serving man who had run somewhere returned with a geomancer, and with priests and their drums, and with all those whose duty it is to come with such an untoward death. And in the commotion Wong the Tiger went away, and waited in a room alone. But when he had waited and done all that he should do as brother in so sad a house, he mounted his horse, and he rode away. And as he went he was sadder than he had been, and he was compelled to harden himself, and to remember again and again how he had never beaten the lad or treated him ill in any way, and none could have known he had this despair in him to take his own life. And Wong the Tiger told himself it was so destined by heaven, and not any man could have averted this thing, for so the life of everyone is holy with heaven. Thus he forced himself to forget the pale lad, and how he had looked when his head lay over his father's arm. And Wong the Tiger said to himself, "Even sons are not all blessing, it may be." When he had comforted himself like this, he was better, and he called heartily to the pocked lad, "Come, lad, there is a long road before us, and we must set out upon it." Chapter 12. When Wong the Tiger struck his horse with the braided leathern whip he carried, and he let the beast have its full way, and the horse sped over the countryside as though it were winged. It was the day fit to start upon so high a venture as Wong the Tiger's, for the sky was cloudless, and the wind blew keen and cool and full of vigor, and it turned the trees this way and that, and wrenched at them, and whipped the late leaves from their branches, and it stirred the dust in the roadways and whirled itself over the shorn grain lands. In Wong the Tiger's heart, a recklessness rose like the very wind itself, and he purposely took his way far from the earthen house, and he made a wide circle from the place where Pear Blossom lived, and he said to his own heart, "All the past is finished, and I look forward to my greatness and to my glory." So the day began, and the sun rose full and enormous and glittering over the edge of the fields. But he looked at it unblinking, and it seemed to him that heaven itself set its seal upon him in such a day as this, and he would achieve his greatness, for greatness was his destiny. Early in the morning he came to the hamlet where his men were, and his trusty hair-lipped man came out to meet him, and he said, "It is very well, my captain, that you have come, for the men are rested and full of food, and they are chafing to be on to more freedom."
"Round them out, then, when they have had their morning meal," shouted Wong the Tiger, "and let us be on our way, and halfway to our own lands by tomorrow."
Now during these days that Wong the Tiger had been in the house of Wong the Second, he had been thinking much of what lands he should take for his own rule, and he had talked with his brother, who was cautious and wise, and it seemed to them that the lands just over into the borders of the next province were very good lands for the purpose and the best to be had. These regions were far enough from Wong the Tiger's home, so that if dire need came he would not be taking from those who were his own people, and yet near enough so that if he were vanquished in a war he could take refuge among his own. Moreover, it was near enough so that silver he would need until he was established could be brought to him easily and without too great risk of robbers. As for the lands themselves,
They were famous good lands where the famine did not strike too often, and some of the lands were high and some were low, and there were mountains to serve for retreat and hiding. There was besides all this a certain highway that was a passage between the north and south for travelers coming to and fro, and such travelers could very well be taxed for revenues and the right to pass that way. There were two or three large towns, too, and a small city, so that Wang the Tiger need not be wholly dependent upon the people who tilled the earth. These lands had another value also, and it was that they sent out the best grain to the markets for wine, and the people were not very poor. There was but one hindrance to all these goods, and it was that there was already a lord of war over that region, and Wang the Tiger must first drive him out if he was to prosper to the utmost, for there is no region rich enough to maintain two lords of war. Now what this lord was, or who he was, or how strong he was, were things Wang the Tiger did not know, for he could not find out anything sure from his brothers, except that they had heard him called the Leopard, because he had such a strange slanting forehead sloping back into his head, as leopards' foreheads do, and he ruled the people harshly, so that they hated him. Therefore Wang the Tiger knew he must go secretly to those lands, and not in any bold array. No, he must go stealthily, separating his men into small bands, so that they would not look more dangerous than bands of deserting soldiers. And he would seek out some retreat in a mountain, and from that vantage he would search out the country with his trusty men, and see what sort of a lord of war he had to fight, and from whom he must take the lands he felt were already his by destiny. As he planned, so he did. When his men were gathered out of the hamlets, and when he had seen each man fed and warmed with good wine against the chill winds that contended with the heat of the mounting sun, when he had taken care that all was paid for, and he had asked the villagers, "Did my men do anything in your houses? They should not," and had heard them answer volubly, "No, they did not. We wish all soldiers were like yours." Then Wang the Tiger was well pleased, and he drew his men far out beyond the villages, and he told them as they stood about him of the lands to which he would lead them, and he said, "There are the best lands anywhere, and there is only one lord to fight against. There is much heady wine, too, in that land, as you have never tasted before." When the men heard this, they shouted with joy, and they clamored, "Take us there, our captain. We have longed for such lands." Then Wang the Tiger answered them, smiling his grim smile, "It is not so easy as this, for we must search out the strength of the lord who holds it. If his men are too many for us, we must seek ways of winning them away from him, and every man of you must be a spy to see and to hear. Nor must anyone know why we are come, or we are undone. I will go myself first to see where we can make our camp, and my trusty hare-lipped man shall stay at the border at a hamlet there called the Valley of Peace. He will stay at an inn there that I have heard of, and it is the very last inn on the street, and there is a wine flag hanging out of the door. He is to wait for you, and give you the name of the place I shall set for us to gather. Now you are to break up into threes and fives and sevens, and saunter as though you were runaways, and if any man asks you where you go, ask him where the leopard is, for you come to join him. To everyone I will give 3 pieces of silver for food until we meet, but there is one thing I say to every man. If it comes to my ears that any man has injured a humble man, or looked at a woman not free to him, I shall not ask what man it is, but I will kill 2 men for every such man I hear about." Then one man called out,
"But, my captain, are we never to be free to do the things soldiers may?"
And Wang the Tiger shouted at him,
"When I give the command, you are free. But you have not fought for me yet, and shall you have the rewards of battle when there has been no battle?"
The man was silent then, and he was afraid, for Wang the Tiger was known to be very sudden in his tempers and swift with his sword, and he was not a man whom one could move with a witty word or a merry saying fitly spoken. Yet he was known to be just, too, and these men who followed him were good enough, and they knew what was fair. It was true they had not fought yet, and they were willing to wait so long as they were fed and sheltered and paid. Then Wang the Tiger watched them as they scattered into groups, and when they were so scattered, he paid them from the store he had, and with a pocked lad on his ass and the hare-lipped trusty man upon a mule Wang the Tiger had bought for him at a hamlet, the 3 started alone toward the northwest. When Wang the Tiger came to the border of that region of which he had heard, he forced his red horse up a large, tall grave of some rich man's that stood there,
and from this vantage he looked out over the land. It was the fairest land he had ever seen, and it spread itself out before him, rolling in little low hills and in wide shallow valleys that were already faintly green with the newly sprouted winter wheat. To the northwest, the hills rose suddenly into jagged mountains full of cliffs, cut clearly against the bright sky of the day. The houses of the people of that land were scattered in small villages and hamlets, good earthen houses not fallen into decay, and many had the roofs newly thatched with straw from that year's harvest. There were even a few houses of brick and tile. In every dooryard near enough for him to see, there were ricks of straw, and he could hear the distant cackling of hens that had laid their eggs. And now and again the wind blew to him where he stood fragments of some song a farmer sang as he cultivated his fields. It was a very fair land, and his heart leaped to see how fair it was. But he had had no mind to go through, clad as he was in a soldier's garb and on his red horse, and let a rumor of war loose too early upon the people. No, he looked and he planned out for himself a winding way to the mountains, where he could hide himself and his men, and seek out the strength of his enemy before any could even know he was come. At the foot of the low hill upon which this tall grave and many other graves were, was a little village, the border village of which he had told his men. It stretched out its few furlongs of one street, and Wong the Tiger turned his horse there, and he rode through it, with the pair behind him. It was at that time of the morning when farmers returned to their own hamlets, and the village tea-house was full of farmers drinking tea or supping up bowls of noodles made from wheaten flour or buckwheat. They had their baskets emptied from the markets piled on the ground beside them as they ate, and they looked up in wonder when they heard the clattering of hooves upon the street, and they stared with jaws ajar as Wong the Tiger passed. He looked back at them, too, to see what sort of men they were, and he was very pleased to see how goodly they were, how brawny and brown and hearty, and how well fed. And he said to himself freshly he had chosen his lands very well, if it could breed such men as these. But save that he looked at them, he went with unusual modesty, and as one goes who passes through a place a guest, and going on to some other far place. At the end of the street there was the wine shop he had heard of, and he told the pair to wait outside, and he halted his horse and dismounted, and he pushed aside the curtain at the door and went into the shop. There was no one there, for it was a very small place with but a table or so for guests, and Wong the Tiger sat down and slapped the table with his hand. A lad came running out then, and seeing how fierce a man was there, he ran back to his father, who was the keeper of the shop. And the man came out and wiped the table with his torn apron, and he said courteously, "My lord guest, what will you have for wine?"
"What have you?" returned Wong the Tiger.
The shopkeeper answered him,
"We have the fresh sorghum wine made in these parts. It is the best wine, and shipped over the whole earth, I suppose, even to the emperor in the capital."
At this Wong the Tiger laughed in some scorn, and he said,
"Have you not heard in this little village that we have no emperor these days?"
At this a great look of terror came over the man's face, and he said in a whisper,
"No, and I had not heard it. When did he die? Or was his throne taken by violence? And if it was, who is our new emperor?"
And Wong the Tiger marveled that there could be a man so ignorant as this, and he replied with some slight scorn,
"We have no new emperor these days at all."
"Then who rules us?"
said the man in consternation, as at some new disaster newly fallen on him unawares.
"It is a time of striving," said Wong the Tiger. "There are many rulers, and it is not known which can seize the highest seat. It is such a time as any man may use to rise to glory."
This he said, and the ambition that was the greatest part of him soared up suddenly, and he cried to his own heart,
"And why may not that one be I?"
But he said nothing aloud. He only sat and waited for his wine beside the small unpainted table. Then the man, when he had fetched the jug of wine, came back, and it could be seen from his sober face that he was much troubled, and he said to Wong the Tiger,
"It is a very evil thing to have no emperor, for this is to have a body without a head, and this means wild movements everywhere, and none to guide us all. It is an ill thing you have told me, my lord guest, and I wish you had not told me, for now I shall not be able to forget it. Humble as I am, I shall not be able to forget it, and however peaceful our village is, I shall be afraid every day for the next."
And with downcast looks the man poured the warm wine into a bowl. But Wong the Tiger did not answer, for he had his thoughts elsewhere than on this humble soul. and as for him, he was glad it was such an hour as it was. He poured out the wine and drank it down quickly. It spread through his blood, hot and strong, and he felt it mount to his cheeks and fume through his head. He did not drink above a few bowls of it then, but he paid for it and for a bowl more, and this he took out to his trusty hair-lipped man. The man was very grateful for it, too, and he took the bowl in both his hands and supped as best he could, lapping it somewhat as a dog does to taste it, and then throwing his head back and pouring it down his throat because his upper lip was so little used to him, divided as it was. Then Wong the Tiger went back into the shop, and he said to the keeper, "And who rules you here in this region?" The man looked east and west at this, but there was no one near, and so he said in a low voice, "It is a robber chief who is called the Leopard. He is the cruelest, bitter fellow. Every one of us must pay a tax to him, or he comes sweeping down on us with all his ne'er-do-wells, he and his men like a flock of evil crows to pick us clean. Well do we all wish we could be rid of him."
"But is there none to contend with him?" asked Wong the Tiger, and he sat down as though it were a small, careless thing, he said, and of no importance to him.
And to seem more careless, he said,
"Bring me a pot of mild green tea. The wine stays like fire in my throat."
And as the man fetched the tea, he answered Wong the Tiger,
"Not one to contend, my lord guest. We would complain of him to those above if it were of use so to do. Once we did go to our country court, and the highest magistrate in our region lives there. We told him our case, and we asked him to send his soldiers out and to borrow soldiers from the one yet above him, and see if together they could not drive out this fellow who oppresses us. But, sir, when those soldiers came, they were such cruel men, and they so lived in our houses and took our daughters, and so ate their fill of what they would, and did not pay us, that they grew to be a burden we could not bear. No, and besides this, they were such cowards that they ran at the very smell of a battle, and the robbers grew all the more arrogant. So we went then and begged the magistrate to take his soldiers off from us again, and he did at last. But it was a very bitter thing at best, for many of the soldiers went and took service under the robbers, giving as excuse that they had not been paid for long and they must eat, and we were worse off than before, for a soldier has a gun to take with him where he goes. And as if it were not enough, that magistrate of ours who lives in the county seat there sent out his tax-gatherers and put a heavy tax upon us all, on men, on the lands, and on keepers of shops too, because he said the state had been put to such a cost to protect us that we must pay them for it. Well enough we knew he and his opium pipe were the state, and so since that time we have never asked for any help, choosing rather to pay so much and so much to the Leopard every feast day and so keep him in bounds. It is well enough while we have no famine, and we have had so many good years now that heaven will surely send us a bad year soon, and there must be many bad years in store for us. Then I do not know how we shall do."
To all of this long tale, Wong the Tiger listened carefully as he drank his tea. Then he asked again,
"Where does this Leopard live?"
Then the wine shopkeeper took Wong the Tiger by the sleeve, and he led him to a small window at the east of the shop, and he pointed with his crooked forefinger, stained with wines, and he said,
"There is a mountain yonder with two crests, and it is called the Double Dragon Mountain. Between the two crests is a valley, and in that valley is the robber's lair."
Now this was what Wong the Tiger waited to hear, and so he affected the more negligence of it, and he said carelessly, smoothing his hard mouth with his hand,
"Well, I shall stay away from that mountain then. And now I must be on the way to my home northward. Here is the silver I owe you. As for the wine, it is as you say it is, a very good, bright, heady wine."
Then Wong the Tiger went out, and he mounted his horse again, and with the two behind him he rode around about so as not to pass any more villages. He rode over the tops of circling hills and through lonely places, although he was never far from men either, because that place was so well tilled and so full of hamlets and villages. But he kept his eyes fixed on that double-crested mountain, and he guided his horse to the south of it to a certain other lower mountain he saw that was partly wooded with pine trees. All through that day they rode in silence, for no one spoke to Wong the Tiger if he did not speak first, unless there were some very pressing thing to be said. Once the lad began to sing a little under his breath, because he was such an one as found silence wearisome, but Wong the Tiger hushed him sternly, for he was in no mood for any merry noise. At the end of the afternoon, but before the sun was set, They came to the foot of that wooded mountain toward which they had been many hours riding, and Wong the Tiger dismounted from his weary horse and began to climb some rude stone steps that led upward. These he followed, and the pair behind him also, their beasts stumbling over the stones. And as they went, the mountain grew wilder, and there were cliffs over which the road led, and streams burst forth here and there between the rocks and the trees, and the grasses grew thick and deep. The mosses upon the stones also were soft, and showed but little sign of the passage of human feet except in the very center, as though only one or two persons ever passed this way. When the sun was set, they had reached the end of this mountain road, and it ended at a temple built of rough stone and set with its back to the cliff, so that indeed this cliff was its innermost wall. The temple was very nearly hidden by trees, but it could be seen because its faded red walls gleamed out in the setting sun. It was but a small temple, old and ruinous, and its gates were closed. Wong the Tiger went up to it, and for a while he stood with his ear pressed against the closed gate. But he heard nothing, and so he beat upon it with the handle of his leathern whip. No one came for a long time, and then he beat very furiously and with anger. At last, the door opened a little, and the face of a shorn and shaven priest looked out, a very old and shriveled face. And Wong the Tiger said, "We seek for shelter here tonight." And as he spoke, his voice rang out hard and sharp and clear in that quiet place. But the priest opened the door a very little more, and he answered in a little piping voice, "Are there no inns and tea-houses in the villages? We be but a scant handful of men who have left the world, and have but the poorest of food without any meat, and we drink only water." And his old knees shook in his robes when he looked at Wong the Tiger. But Wong the Tiger pushed his way in through the gates and past that old priest, and he called to his lad and the trusty man, "Here is the very place for which we seek." He went in then without any heed at all to the priests. He went into the temple through the main hall where the gods were, and they were like the temple, very aged, and their guilt peeling from their clay bodies. But Wong the Tiger did not even look at them. He passed them and went into the inner side houses where the priests lived, and he chose out a small room for himself, better than the others, and cleaned not too many days ago. Here he ungirdled his sword, and the trusty man went hither and thither and found food and drink for him, although it was only a little rice and cabbage. But that night, as Wong the Tiger laid himself down upon the bed in the room he had chosen, he heard a deep, low wailing come out of the hall where the gods were, and he rose and went out to see what it was. There the five old priests of the temple were, and the two little acolytes they had, who were farmer sons, left there for some prayer answered. They all knelt and wailed to the Buddha, who sat leaning on his fat belly in the center of the hall, and as they wailed, they prayed the god to save them. A torch burned there, and the flame flew this way and that in the night winds, and in the light of the flying flame these knelt and prayed aloud. Now Wong the Tiger stood and looked at them, and listened to them, and he found that they prayed to be protected against him, and they cried, save us from the robber. When he heard this, Wong the Tiger shouted out heartily, and the priests leaped to hear his sudden voice, and they stumbled to their feet and tangled in their robes with their haste, all except one old priest who was the abbot of that temple, and he fell flat on his face, thinking his last hour was come. But Wong the Tiger shouted, "I shall not hurt you, you old bald heads! Look, I have silver to spare, and why should you be afraid of me?" And as he spoke, he opened his girdle purse, and he showed them the silver he carried there, and it was true there was more silver in it than they had ever seen. And he said on, "Beyond this I have more silver, and I want nothing of you except shelter for a little while, such as any man may claim in his need from a temple." The sight of his silver did comfort the priests very much, and they looked at one another, and they said among themselves, "He is some military captain or other who has killed a man he should not have killed, or who has lost his general's favor, and so he must hide for a little time. We have heard of such." As for Wong the Tiger, he let them think what they would, and he smiled his slight and mirthless smile, and he went back to his bed. The next day at dawn, Wong the Tiger rose, and he went out to the gate of the temple. It was a morning of mists, and the clouds filled the valleys, and covered this mountain top from every other, and he was alone and hid from the world. Nevertheless, the chill in the air reminded him that winter must soon come, and he had much to do before snow set in, for his men depended on him for food and shelter and for clothing against the cold. So he went into the temple again, and he went into a kitchen where his trusty man and the lad slept. They had covered themselves with straw, and they still slept, and the breath whistled through the man's split lip. They slept fast enough, although already an acolyte was feeding straw carefully into the mouth of the brick oven, and from under the wooden lid of the iron cauldron on the bricks, a bubble of steam leaked out. When the acolyte saw Wong the Tiger, he shrank back and hid himself. But Wong the Tiger paid no heed to him. He shouted to his trusty man and seized him and shook him, and bade him rise and eat and get gone to the inn, lest some of the men pass that morning. Then did the trusty man stagger up out of his sleep, rubbing his two hands over his face and yawning hideously. But he shuffled into his clothes, and he dipped a bowl into the simmering cauldron, and supped some of the scalding sorghum gruel the acolyte brewed there. Away he went down the mountain then, a goodly enough man if one saw only his back and not his face, and Wong the Tiger watched him go and valued him for his faithfulness. Then as Wong the Tiger waited that day for his men to gather to him in this lonely place, he planned what he would do, and whom he would trust for his trusty men to be his helpers and take counsel with him. He portioned out certain labor to certain numbers of men also, to these to be spies, and to these to forage for food, and to others to gather fuel, and to others cooking and the mending and cleaning of weapons, to each man his share in their common life. And he thought that he must remember to keep a hard hand over them all, and to reward them only where reward was due, and he would order all under his complete command. Life and death should be in his own hand. Beyond this, he planned how each day he would spend certain hours training his men in feints and postures of war, so that when his times of struggle came they would be ready. He dared not waste his bullets for the guns at practice, seeing he had not many beyond his need yet, but he would teach them what he could. So he waited, restless, in that still mountain top, and before the day was ended there were 50 and more men who had found their way to him again, and by the end of the next day nearly 50 more. The few left never came, and it seemed they had deserted to some other cause. Wong the Tiger waited 2 more days, but they did not come, and he grieved, not because of the men, but because with each he had lost a good gun and a belt of bullets. Now when the old priest saw this horde of men gathering into their peaceful temple, they were beside themselves, and they did not know what to do. But Wong the Tiger comforted them, and he said over and over, "You shall be paid for everything, and you need not fear." But the old abbot answered in his feeble way, for he was very aged, and the flesh upon his bones was dried and shriveled with his age. "It is not only that we fear no return. There are things for which silver makes no restoration. This has been a very quiet place, and its very name is the Temple of Holy Peace. We few have lived out of the world these many years in this place. Now here are all your lusty, hungry men, and peace is gone with their coming. They crowd into the hall where the gods are, and they spew their spittle everywhere, and they stand everywhere, even before a god himself, and pass their water as they please, and they are coarse and wild in all they do." Then Wong the Tiger said, "It is easier for you to move yourselves and your gods than for me to change such things in my men, for they are soldiers. Move your gods then into the innermost hall, and I will tell them that to that one place they shall not go. So may you be at peace." Thus the old abbot did, then, seeing that there was no other way, and they moved every god on its pedestal except the gilt Buddha, who was too large, and they feared if he fell he would burst into pieces and bring disaster upon them all. The soldiers lived in the hall with him then, and the priests covered his face with a piece of cloth, so that he might not see and be angered by what sins they could not avoid. Then Wong the Tiger chose out from his men the 3 he would have as his trusty men. First he took the hair-lipped man, and after him 2 others, one nicknamed the Hawk, because he had a very curious hooked nose in the middle of his thin face, and a narrow, down-drooping mouth, and one nicknamed the Pig Butcher. The Pig Butcher was a great, thick, fat, red man, and his face was large and flat, and his features smashed upon it, as though a hand had smeared him in the making. But he was a lusty fellow, and it was true enough he had once been a pig butcher. But he had killed a neighbor in a brawl, and he would often bemoan it and say, "If I had been eating my rice and had chopsticks in my hand, I could never have killed him. But he quarreled with me when I had my chopping knife in my hand, and the thing seemed to fly out of its own accord." Nevertheless, the man having died of his bleeding, the pig butcher had need to run away to save himself from the court. He had one strange skill. Coarse and thick as he was, he had swift and delicate speed in his hand, so that if he took a pair of chopsticks, he could pluck the flies out of the air as they flew. One by one he plucked them, and many times his fellows would bid him to do this for them to see, and they roared with laughter to see such skill. With this exactness, he could prick a man as delicately and spill his blood out neatly and swiftly, too. Now these three men were very canny men, although not one could read or write. But for such a life as theirs they needed no learning in books, nor did they dream such learning could be useful to them. Wang the Tiger called them to his room when he had chosen them, and he said,
"I shall look to you as my three trusty men above the others to watch them, and to see if any betrays me or fails in what I have commanded. Be sure you shall have a reward on the day when I rise to glory."
Then he sent the hawk out and the pig butcher too, and he kept only the hair-lipped trusty man, and to him he said with great sternness,
"You I set above those other two, and it is your duty to see if they too fail me in loyalty."
Then he called the three together again, and he said,
"As for me, I shall kill anyone whose loyalty is even brought to question. I will kill him so swiftly that the next breath he had planned as a thing of course shall be left half-taken and hanging in the air."
Then his hair-lipped man answered peaceably,
"You need not fear me, my captain. Your own right hand shall betray you before I do so."
Then the other two swore eagerly also, and the hawk said loudest of all,
"Shall I forget you took me as a common soldier and raised me up?"
This he said, for he had his own hopes in him too. Then the three made their obeisances before Wang the Tiger to show their humility and their faithfulness. And when this was over, Wang the Tiger chose out certain tricky, clever men, and he sent them out through the land everywhere to spy out what the news was about his enemy. He commanded,
"Make all haste, and find out what you can so that we can establish ourselves before the great cold begins. Find out how many men follow the leopard, and if you come upon any of them, talk to them and test their loyalty to him, and see if they can be bribed away or not. I will bribe everyone I can, because your lives are more precious to me than silver, and I shall not waste one life if I can buy a man instead."
Then these men took off their soldiers' garb, and they wore their old ragged inner garments, and Wang the Tiger gave them money to buy what they might need of common upper clothes. They went down the mountain then and into the villages and the pawn shops, and bought the old worn clothes that farmers and common men pawn for a few pence, and never redeem again, they are so poor. Thus clad, the men wandered all through the countryside. They idled at inns and at tables where men gamed to pass the time away, and they stayed at wayside shops, and everywhere they listened. Then they came back and told everything to Wang the Tiger. Now what these men told was the same that Wang the Tiger had heard in the wine shop, and it was that the people of these lands hated and feared this robber chief, the leopard, because every year he demanded more of them if he was not to come and lay waste their houses and fields. His excuse was that each year he had a greater horde of men to feed, and he beat off other robbers from the common people, and for this he ought to be paid. It was true that his band grew very large, and larger every year, because every idler in that whole region who did not wish to work, and all who had committed some crime, fled to the lair in the Double Dragon Mountain, and joined the leopard's banner. If they were good fellows and brave, they were very welcome, and if they were weak and cowards, they were kept to serve the others. There were even some women who went there, bold women whose husbands were dead, and who did not care for fame, good or ill, and some men, when they went, took their wives with them. And some women were captives and held for the men's pleasure. And it was true, too, that the leopard did hold off other robber thieves from this whole region. But in spite of this, the people hated him, and they were unwilling to give him anything. Yet whether they wished it or not, they gave, for they had no weapons. In olden days they might have risen with forks and scythes and knives and such simple tools, but now that the robbers had foreign guns, these were of no avail. Nor was any courage or anger of avail against so leaping a death as this. When Wang the Tiger asked his spies how many men followed the leopard, he had strange answers, for some said they had heard 500, and others said 2,000 or 3,000, and others said more than 10,000. He could not find out what the truth was, and he only knew that it was more by many than the men he had. This gave him much to ponder upon, and he saw that he must use guile and keep his guns until the last sharp battle, and he must avoid even this if he could. So he pondered as he sat and listened to what his spies said, and he let them say on freely, knowing that an ignorant man tells most when he does not know it. And the man who loved to be merry, the same one who had named his captain the black-browed tiger, said, making his little weak voice high and boasting,
"As for me, I am so fearless I pushed my way into the largest town, which is the seat of this whole county, and I listened there, and they are afraid there too. Every year this leopard makes a demand at the feast days, and the merchants must give him a vast heap of silver, or he says he will attack the town itself. And I said to the fellow who told me, and he was a vendor of pork balls, the very best I ever did eat, 'They have rare pigs here, my captain, and they put garlic into their meats, and I am glad if we stay here.' And I said, 'But why does your magistrate not send his soldiers out to fight and do battle with this robber for the people's sake?' And that maker of pork balls, he was a good fellow, too, and he gave me a bit of a broken ball more than I paid for. And he said, 'That magistrate of ours sits sunken in his opium, and he is afraid of his own shadow, and the general he keeps for his army has never been to war at all, and he does not know how to hold a gun. A little fuming, fussy fellow he is, who cares more how his soup is brewed than what happens to us. As for that magistrate, you should see the guards he keeps about him, and he pays them more and more, lest they turn against him or be bribed by someone, and he spends out money like one pours tea on the ground out of a cold pot. And with all this he is so afraid he shivers and shakes if the leopard's name is even mentioned, and he moans to be free and yet does not make a stir of his hand, and every year he pays out more to the leopard to keep him off.' So this vendor told me, and when I had eaten the pork and saw he was in no mind to give me more even if I paid for one more, I went on, and I talked with a beggar who sat picking the lice out of his garments in a sunny spot between two walls. He was a wise old man, too, who begged all his life in the streets of that town. He was the cleverest old man, and he bit off the head of every louse he pinched, and he crunched them. He was well fed, I swear, with all the lice he had. And he said, when we had talked of many things, that the magistrate this year seemed more of a mind to do something, because those higher had heard how he let a robber rule in his regions, and there were many who craved his place, and they were bringing an accusation against him at the higher court that he does not do his duty, and if he must come down there are a dozen who will strive for his place, because these regions are so good and full of revenue. And the people grieve over this too, for they say, 'Well, we have fed this old wolf, and he is not so greedy as he was, and if a new one comes in ravenous, he must be fed from the very start again.'"
Thus Wang the Tiger let his men talk as they would, and they did as ignorant men will, telling all they heard and guffawing and making merry, for they were full of high hopes, and they had faith in their captain. And everyone was fed and pleased with the land and with the hamlets they had passed through. For although the people had to feed these two, the leopard and the magistrate, still they had enough left to feed themselves well enough too, for it was such a goodly land, and much was left them. And Wang the Tiger let them talk, and if much they said was no worth, still they often let fall something he wanted to know, and he could sift the wheat from the chaff, for he was much wiser than they. As this fellow ceased his piping, Wang the Tiger laid hold on the last thing he had said, that the magistrate feared lest he lose his place, and he thought deeply on this, and it seemed to him that here was the secret of the whole venture, and through this weak old man he might seize the power over these lands. The more he listened to his men, the more sure he grew that the leopard was not so strong as he had thought, and after a time he made up his mind that he would send a spy to the very stronghold of the robber's lair, and see what men were there and all the leopard had for strength. He looked about his men as they sat that night at their evening meal, sitting on their haunches, and every man with a roll of hard bread to gnaw and a bowl of grain gruel to sup, and for a time he could not decide which of them to send, and none seemed clever and wise enough. Then his eye fell on his nephew, the lad he kept near him, and he was at this instant gorging himself, his cheeks puffed and full with food. Wang the Tiger did but walk away to his own room, and the lad followed him instantly, as it was his duty to do, and Wang the Tiger bade him close the door and stand to hear what he said. And he said, "Are you brave enough for a certain thing I shall tell you?" And the lad said sturdily, still chewing his great mouthful, "Try me, my uncle, and see." And Wang the Tiger said, "I will try you. You are to take a little sling such as lads use to kill birds, and you are to go to that double-crested mountain, and go about evening time, and pretend you have lost your way,